Sandy, who had heard my story about the deserted lyre, gave me a gift that I treasure as much as anything he has ever given me, including the deer antlers. It was a small replica of a fresco from Minoan Crete that pictured a woman playing a lyre made from two golden snakes. Sandy's card read, "Strum your heart out." The lyric Sappho is another image of an empowered female self. She is the woman in us who takes up her real work, creates, sings her verses to the world, and she does so through the connection she establishes with her deep feminine instinct, a connection symbolized in the picture by the golden snakes. To be empowered as women, eventually we must turn our snakes into lyres and strum our hearts out. When I lament the loss of women's creativity through history, my friend Karen in Utah reminds me that women's creativity has always been there, but many times it was erased from history or stolen and used by men. Karen is a musician who has studied women composers. They've always been there, she says, but have been left out of dictionaries and catalogs, often by 19th century men. Yet women's creativity has also been absent because of women's subordination and the denial of their value. Rather than creating ourselves, we've often been content to be muses to men, making their creativity possible. Sometimes, when we have created, we've not used the mother tongue of our own soul, but parroted patriarchal thought, turning out reframed versions of what we've heard it saying. And as Karen points out, when we have spoken in our true creative voices, we frequently have been neglected, obscured, or overlooked. I cannot tell you how many women I meet who say, "Oh, I'm just not creative." It breaks my heart, because every woman is creative in some way, and every woman's creativity is valuable. Perhaps we think of creativity too narrowly. When a woman takes a cornfield and turns it into a woodland garden where women gather to talk and dance and feed their souls, like my friend Betty did, she is being a lyrical Sappho, creating out of her soul. When she develops an imaginative plan through which businesses can give a portion of their sales to abused women's shelters and environmental groups, like another friend of mine did, she too is strumming the lyre of snakes. If someone should ask me, "What does the soul do?" I would say, it does two things. It loves, and it creates. Those are its primary acts. The replanted, rewoven female soul sets loose a fecund spirit inside us. We grow fertile with new words, new ideas, new consciousness, new lyricism, new energy. Our journey deposits psychological or spiritual energy, empowerment, into our internal banks. As Mary Catherine Bateson points out, there is physical energy from finite resources, but psychic or spiritual energy, what might be called vitality, is something else entirely. "The energy to write this page is released by metabolized food," writes Bateson. "But the psychic energy to write this page depends on my state of mind, and such energy can come from a sunset or a remembered smile." The energy or vitality to create is engendered from the soul. The first step toward lyricism is simply acknowledging our creativity. Second, we must explore it. Ask yourself, what is my deepest passion, really? What moves me profoundly? And let the answer float up from the truest, most vulnerable place in your heart. Greet this answer like it is your own newborn self being placed in your arms. Love it. Bond with it. Feed it. Don't push it aside, minimize, make excuses, and starve this thing of beauty, because this answer is the window into your creative life. Third, we need to commit to our creative path. I don't mean to want to do it in our hearts, or to make plans to do it. I mean to actually do it. When I teach at writers' conferences, I often meet women with books inside them they never write down. I meet women with all kinds of dazzling projects their souls have concocted that for some reason they never get around to manifesting. I know this dilemma firsthand. For me, it is often a lack of focus, allowing my energy to run out in dozens of directions, many of them silly tributaries of distraction, rather than setting priorities and funneling my energy toward the project at hand. Part of women's genius lies in our ability to make multiple commitments, to do many tasks, and to live with ambiguity and multiplicity. It's true that power can come from the flexibility of doing many things, But sometimes the multiplicity, the moving from one thing to another, is overdone, and we diffuse our power. There are times it is best to dam up the tributaries and send the energy thundering in just one direction. All great things are launched on big rivers. Closely connected is the matter of drawing boundaries. A retired woman came to me, miserable and frustrated, and said every time she set aside time to write, her husband would come into the room and launch into all sorts of topics, or else stare at her pitifully until she stopped. She had not wanted to confront him, and her writing had practically ceased. I suggested to her that there comes a time when we have to put our foot down. Clarissa Pinkola Estes writes, "If we were to abuse our children, social services would show up at our doors. If we were to abuse our pets, the Humane Society would come to take us away. But there is no creativity patrol or soul police to intervene if we insist on starving our own souls." Empowerment involves learning to make boundaries and protect them. If it happens that my husband and college-aged children are home, and I'm in the midst of a project that needs absolute focus, I close my study door. I tell them, if there's an emergency, a real emergency, and not, have you seen my reading glasses, or is there anything to eat around here, knock twice. Otherwise, leave me be. Another problem that keeps us from manifesting our creativity is a resistance to act. I'm not talking about being creatively idle. Sometimes I do my best creative work when I am spread-eagled on the grass with my eyes closed. Never lose that sort of sacred dawdling. The resistance to act is of a different sort. It is an odd contention that rises up inside and keeps us from beginning and then keeps us from following through. How are we going to live empowered lives if we don't lose that? Better to strangle an infant in its cradle than nurse unacted desires, said William Blake. A little strong, I think, but we get the message. Often we like to dwell in the rapturous realm of imagination, passion, and ideas, but hate to follow through with the legwork that brings those images, passions, and ideas into actual existence. I've had to learn this many times. Tapping the flow of the soul is only half the creative process. The other half is figuring out how to do commerce with the practical world. Maybe we have to learn how to use a computer, or make a plan to market our idea, or network with people, or go out and find the place to hold the workshop. Being committed means learning what we need to know and doing what we need to do in order to make the voice of our souls heard. And finally, to be empowered creatively, we need to understand what to do when we move from lyricism back to silence. Inevitably, I get discouraged and lose creative direction or passion, that psychic or spiritual energy I was referring to earlier. When that happens, I've learned to drop down into the creative nothing. I do sacred dawdling. I turn to nature. I lie on the earth or dig in the dirt. I get still, go silent, rest, take herbal baths, listen to Bach's Brandenburg Concerto or James Taylor full blast. I buy flowers. I drink cinnamon tea, play with my dogs, meditate, and create rituals. The main thing is to stop struggling and nourish yourself. When you nourish yourself, your creative energy is renewed. You are able to pick up your lyre again and sing. Finding inner authority. Empowerment also comes into a woman's life as she finds her inner authority. The word authority has lots of meanings, both positive and negative, but I like the meaning that comes from the Greek, to stand forth with power and dignity. Often we recognize or acknowledge this authority for the first time when our female backs are against the wall, when some challenge or opposition comes along, and we feel our mettle being tested. It happened for me in the spring of that same year when I was coming out of the woods and dreaming of buffalo. I delivered a speech on feminine spirituality and the ecological crisis at a mainline denominational conference. It was my first address on the suppression of the feminine within Christianity since becoming grounded in feminine spiritual consciousness, and I was feeling pretty nervous. After I closed my speech, I remained at the podium for an open dialogue with an audience of a few hundred, about half men and half women. It was an audience, on the whole, wonderfully open to my message, but then a male clergyman rose to his feet, pointed his finger at me, and shook it as if scolding a rebellious child.
Young lady.
I don't recall his words precisely, but basically he wanted me and the audience to know that traditions concerning women should not be tampered with, that women like me should cut this kind of stuff out. He wanted me to know that he had daughters and he would never want them, much less the church, to hold outrageous ideas like mine. There was a time when something like this would have blown me away, as the saying goes. His voice would have resounded as the authoritarian male voice, the voice of the patriarchal church, the voice of the culture, even the voice of Father God. And it would have left me unnerved, vulnerable, doubtful, afraid, wishing for a hole so I could disappear inside it, wishing I'd kept my mouth shut. I remember standing there as he went on and on, waiting for my knees to buckle. But they didn't. Instead, I found myself remembering a greeting card I'd purchased only a few days earlier, with a quote on the front by poet Audre Lorde. It said, "When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid." I almost smiled remembering it. It was like a big dose of buffalo medicine, and the feeling of solidity, which I'd been gradually sensing, was right there. I felt it like a hand slowly turning to fist inside my belly. It made me reposition my feet, plant them solid, and lift my chin. Funny thing, though, I didn't feel reactive. Not angry, not threatened, not the slightest need to defend myself. I merely felt firm, rooted in some kind of new power. In fact, I was so caught by the surprise of these feelings, I rather lost what the man was going on about. When I refocused my attention on him, I thought how admirably he represented patriarchy. I kept thinking that here is a frightened man reacting. And so when he finished, there seemed nothing left for me to say that he had not already unwittingly demonstrated. "Obviously, we have very different visions about women," I said, and then I went on. I think that's when I first realized that feminine journeys really do yield empowered female lives, that new authority issues out of our experiences. Sometimes, though, people tend to mistake female authority for female bullishness. For instance, in a small group during a women's retreat, as we were discussing female empowerment, a woman told us that she was a strong woman like her mother. "We don't take anything from anybody," she said. The more she talked, the more it became apparent that, like her mother, she ran the house, ran her husband, ran the show. What she thought of as female power was really being overbearing and opinionated, controlling and argumentative, enforcing one's will in a driven way. Running the show is hardly female authority. To stand firm with power and dignity has little to do with ordering people around, constantly uncorking a lot of strong opinions and judgments, controlling things, or spouting off when someone pushes your button. Eventually, the women recognized that, like the rest of us, she and her mother had their own wounded feminine life inside, that they too had been severed from their feminine souls, and because of that had learned to mimic the ways of patriarchy. What they mistook for female strength and authority was recycled patriarchal power. We find genuine female authority within when we become the author of our own identity. By taking the journey to the feminine soul, we authorize ourselves. Anne Ulanoff, professor at Union Theological Seminary, writes that a woman who has found her authority is securely and consciously anchored in her own feminine being. As a matter of course, this woman begins to experience the internal solidity I was beginning to notice, the change in substance. She comes to the solid center of herself and finds her own ground to stand on. And she stands there with her own authority. Rather than needing to control and enforce things, she stands, steady and dignified, in this authority, with a knowing that is barnacled to her insides, that gives her the gumption and the enterprise to act in behalf of her vision and her soul. It's what allows her to do intrepid things, sometimes being gentle, sometimes fierce, sometimes waiting, sometimes leaping, but always knowing who she is. the one-in-herself woman. As summer came, I read physician Esther Harding's book on feminine psychology, coming upon a train of thought that at first baffled, then intrigued me. Harding spoke about a woman who may be married and have children, or may have much sexual experience, but is a virgin. Naturally, I wondered how a woman manages a thing like that. Harding points out that in ancient times the word virgin had a different meaning than it does now. It didn't mean being chaste or physically untouched. Rather, being a virgin meant belonging to oneself. Being a virgin, she says, refers to a quality, a subjective state, a psychological attitude, not to a physiological or external fact. For a woman, it means she is uncaptured, or, as Harding puts it, she is one in herself. In that context, a married woman, a mother, or any sexually experienced woman can be a virgin. It means that while she may relate fully to her partner, she does not give herself away to him or to patriarchy. She gives herself to her own soul. She is her own mistress, her own authority, her own woman. Once when I tried to explain this to someone, she thought I meant that in being a virgin we would have no need for anyone else. But that wasn't it at all. By now I knew how intricately connected I was. If anything, as I belonged more and more to myself, I was able to relate more deeply and truly to those in my life. The relationships became something I chose, not something I felt dependent on or trapped in. Being one in myself wasn't an aloof containment, but a spiritual and psychological autonomy. It meant being whole and complete in myself, and relating to others out of that soul-centeredness. The journey to Crete, which I've referred to many times, took place the following fall. Before departing, I read about an ancient rite performed by the pre-patriarchal goddess Hera. The myth said every year she would return for a ritual bath in the Kanathos spring in Greece to renew her virginity or her quality of belonging to herself. While in Crete, our leader, a scholar in women's spirituality and goddesses of the ancient Mediterranean, mentioned that ancient women took part in these same baths, immersing themselves three times in the sea in order to reclaim their virginity. So one free afternoon in the village of Moklos, I swam out into the sea with my friend Terry, the same Terry who'd led me to the buffalo in Colorado. A few hundred yards out in the water was a tiny deserted island that contained nothing but scruffy brush and some ancient Greek ruins. We planned to spend the afternoon there. Behind us in the water, we pulled a child's inflated plastic boat, which we'd purchased in the village. It was loaded with supplies Terry had brought from home to make masks, rolls of plaster of Paris, scissors, Vaseline to protect our faces from the plaster, towels, bottles of water. It had been her idea to make a mask here, to capture an image of ourselves to take back home and paint. As we dragged our little boat up onto the shore, I couldn't help but think of Naxos, the island where Ariadne had been deserted by Theseus. The thought stayed with me as Terry and I went exploring and finally came to a part of a ruin at the water's edge. It was a low rock wall with some kind of basin cut into the stone, maybe part of an ancient house or temple. We spread out our supplies, filled the ageless basin with seawater, and cut the plaster into strips. Then we picked our way barefooted over the stones down to the sea. We waded our waist high and immersed ourselves three times. I remember most the shock of coldness as I went under, the rhythmic, almost mesmerizing immersion down and under, the gauzy light sifting under the water, and then the way the sun spattered on the surface when I came sputtering up the third time. I remember the rinsed look of everything, the determination in my chest, the power in my belly. After drying off, I spread a towel on the ground inside the ruin and lay down. Terry spread the plaster of Paris strips over my face, covering everything but my eyes and nostrils. "You have to be perfectly still," she said, "until it dries." Lying silent in the Greek sun, the plaster tightened and seemed to dissolve into my skin, becoming part of me. Earlier, when we'd talked about which aspect of ourselves we wanted the mask to symbolize, I'd thought of Ariadne. Now I replayed her story again, how after Ariadne had been abandoned on Naxos, she turned inward, finding her own resources. On Naxos, she'd become one in herself. Just a few days earlier, the tour bus driver had pointed to the craggy brown island of Naxos sitting out in the Aegean. Lying now on the Moklos Island, drowsy with sun and meditation and myth, I could easily imagine it as Naxos, the space of becoming one in herself. Finally, Terry lifted away the dried mask and put it into my hands, gazing at my cheeks, chin, forehead, nose, lips. I remembered this face going into the sea 3 times. The mask represented the face of the woman who came up out of the water. It registered in me as the image of an empowered self. It made me think of the female authority that comes when we start to belong to ourselves, to our own souls. Back home, I painted the mask green. On it, I glued rocks, feathers, and shells from Crete, a brass labyrinth, and a coil of the string that my friend Betty and I had followed that night we moved through the woods, learning how to follow our thread. Today, the mask of the one-in-herself woman sits on a stand in my study. When I look at her, I feel the solid knowing in my belly. I remember who I am and who I hope to be. I smile at her a lot. Iron-Jawed Angels. I flipped the channel to PBS one night and landed in the middle of a program about the suffragettes. I tuned in just in time to see policemen taking women away from the front of the White House, where they had stood holding signs that asked, "How long must women wait for liberty?" The women were hauled away to jail, but then another handful of women came with the same determined look in their faces and held up the same signs. They were taunted by passing men, but also by other women, a thing that seemed incredulous on first glance. I mean, how could these other women believe they should not have the right to vote? Unless, and now suddenly I wasn't thinking only about women in 1920, they'd become so conditioned to subordinate experience and so used to being denied their rights that they'd normalized it. I pondered what caused one group to support the system that subordinated and wounded them, and the other group to believe their rights as women were worth fighting for. Looking at those two disparate groups of women, the things I'd learned during my awakening had never seemed more true. That women internalize the feminine wound or feminine inferiority so deeply, there's little or no female authority and esteem to fall back on. So they seek it by adopting and pleasing patriarchal standards. And my heart went out to these women, too, despite their blindness, because once upon a time, I'd been there. I watched as the suffragettes stood, unflinching, through all the derision. The police came again and took the second group of signholders away. Inevitably, the authorities decided the women with their signs were getting out of hand, so they stepped up their intimidation, interrogating them in jail. The women responded by going on hunger strikes. The authorities insisted they eat. The women refused. The authorities brought in gastric tubes and force-fed them. Still, the women refused to open their mouths to eat. They were, as one sympathetic bystander called them, the iron-jawed angels. In the end, the women couldn't be broken, so they were released. They went back to their signs and their exhausting work of standing firm with power and dignity, and in the end, they won us our right to vote. Having never thought much about these women until I saw that program, I was unprepared for the rush of feeling I had for them, the love, gratitude, and awe for these ordinary women who took on husbands, fathers, government, church, and the entire weight of cultural tradition for the sake of justice. I sat on the sofa a while after the program ended and asked myself about 50 times whether I could have done something like that. The image of the iron-jawed angel became another representation of the feminine power I hoped to nurture. The self inside, who, carrying her own sense of authority and esteem, can exhibit an uncommon resilience and inner toughness, especially when opposition comes. Women who struggle for justice and religious structures, who dare to save the divine from exclusive masculinity, who seek truth instead of defending dogma, need every bit as much of the brawny-hearted strength those iron-jawed angels had. for opposition nearly always comes. I had my moments of it, some large, some small. But remember, at the time it's happening, all opposition feels large. And even when it's quite small, you still have to reach inside for the same unwavering grit. I'm thinking of a phone conversation with a male priest friend who was uncomfortable with my transformation. He said, "Sue, as a priest, I must tell you, by not being faithful to the church as you once were, you're setting the wrong example for your children. They'll be the ones to suffer." Translation, "I am a spiritual authority. I therefore know what's best for you. What's best is for you to get back in line, and I will try to get you there, if necessary, by raising the specter of bad motherhood, the ultimate leverage." When someone tries to put you back into a box from which you've already escaped, you might recall a line from the Indian poet Mirabai. She said, "I have felt the swaying of the elephant's shoulders, and now you want me to climb on a jackass? Try to be serious." Still, hearing opposition as I did from my priest friend can be a mild shock, especially in the beginning. You may have to lay the phone down for a few seconds and breathe. When you finally comprehend what is happening, you may feel the iron-jawed angel wake up inside. You may hear yourself tell the person on the other end of the line that he shouldn't worry, you're your own authority now. Sometimes the more public the opposition, the larger it may seem. Once, when I spoke before a large audience on the feminine spiritual journey, a woman in the back stood up during the question session, raised her Bible, and cried out, "What you're saying is an abomination!" After having her say, and what a say it was, she marched out, inviting others to follow. Fortunately, only one other woman went, but it was high drama, moments I watched in still frame, half believing. Meanwhile, the full realization about the opposition that's out there came crashing down like a piece of the sky. What I did was to stand there and remember every iron-jawed angel I could think of. One I often recall is the old grandmother in the movie Strictly Ballroom. Her granddaughter, along with a partner, wants to dance a daring new dance that breaks with convention. They face a barrage of public opposition because of it, so much that they are about to back off. At this moment, the old grandmother steps forth, sets her iron jaw, looks into her granddaughter's eyes, and says, "A life lived in fear is a life half lived." I try to take that old woman with me at all times. In the end, refusing the fear is what gets us through oppositional experiences. Refusing to half live our lives means going out there and daring our dance. Atop the Acropolis in Greece is a building known as the Erechtheum. The roof on its south porch is supported by the Caryatids, six columns sculpted in the shape of women. While I was in Greece, the sight of the Caryatids holding up that large ancient roof was the most inspiring thing on the Acropolis, even more than the Parthenon. The Caryatids formed the stirring image of strong women bearing up, and I stood there thinking of all the women I knew who had borne up under enormous weight and opposition, and in doing so made a space, a shelter, something of beauty for the rest of us. A friend stood nearby, also gazing at them, and her thoughts must have paralleled mine because she said, "Now there are some strong-necked women." I liked her description, strong-necked women, just another way of saying iron-jawed women. Either way, it was the group I wanted to belong to. Embodying sacred feminine experience. Female empowerment is not only about emerging to voice our souls and finding a new inner authority as women. It is also about something far more simple, embodying our sacred feminine experience. This means bringing it home, so to speak, to our work, play, and relationships. The more we enact our feminine consciousness in our ordinary lives, living out the truth in our souls, the convictions in our hearts, and the wisdom in our bodies, the more empowered we become and the more capable we are of affecting the world immediately around us. Becoming the Circle of Trees. In Crete, we visited a mountaintop shrine called Kato Simi, where thousands of years ago the Great Mother had been worshipped. An ancient tree grows there, The inside of its massive trunk has been hollowed out, and one side of it has worn completely away, leaving a crescent-shaped wall of bark that rises into the sky. The space inside the tree is so large all 15 of us women were able to gather inside it. Standing inside the tree, surrounded by tree trunk and the smell of gnarled bark, I suddenly realized that I was not in a circle of trees, but inside the circle of a single tree. Perhaps it was the deepest circle yet. From this unique perspective, I had the feeling of being taken into the tree, of being part of the tree, part of the trunk and roots and branches. The moment affirmed to me all over again that having sacred feminine experience wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to have a sacred place, to go to a circle of trees in the woods. I needed to become the circle of trees, to be the sacred place wherever I went, to dwell so deeply inside my experience and have it dwell so deeply inside of me that there was no separation between us. Embodiment means we no longer say, I had this experience. We say, I am this experience. You have seen women like this, women who carry their feminine consciousness, their spiritual wisdom, their knowing, so fully and naturally that it is written all over them. I've known powerful women like this, and I find myself wanting to be in their presence and drink deeply. They are mentors, wise women, women whose transfiguration has settled deep inside them. Walt Whitman, in his preface to Leaves of Grass, seems to be describing the very quality these women embody. Re-examine all you have been told in school or church or in any book, and dismiss whatever insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem, and have the richest fluency, not only in words, but in the silent lines of its lips and face, and between the lashes of your eyes, and in every motion and joint of your body. In Margaret Atwood's novel Surfacing, one of the characters says, I lean against a tree. I am a tree leaning. When I read that, I felt it was describing the shift to embodiment. For a long time, we lean against the trees in the circle and they hold us up. But there comes a time when we realize that we must become the tree in the circle, able to hold the leaning of others. A spirituality of naturalness. One particular way we can embody sacred feminine experience in our daily lives is to embrace a spirituality of naturalness. Like spring water, this spirituality arises out of our nature, our feminine nature. It's native to us, not artificial or manufactured, or piped in from some other place. Very simply, this spirituality is true to who we are as women. It comes from within us and flows out. The spirituality we've inherited from patriarchy is laced with a denial of the natural. Patriarchal spirituality becomes a flight from earth, flesh, temporality, and the present. But sacred feminine consciousness seizes us by the shoulders, looks in our eyes, and tells us with passion and simplicity, if you don't get anything else, get this. This is your life, right now, on this changing earth, in this impermanent body, among these excruciatingly ordinary things. This is it. You will not find it anywhere else. A natural and feminine spirituality tends to incorporate three very organic, basic, but overlooked things into our sacred experience: the earthly, the now, and the ordinary. The earthly. I live only a few hours from the ocean, and I try to get there as often as possible. The last time I was there, on a September morning, I took my scarf, a wild purple thing with gold fringe that I'd bought in a used clothing store in New Mexico, and I went down to the shore with my flashlight just before the sun came up, when no one was around, not even the crabbers. I took my scarf and danced in my bare feet in the breaking light, on and on along the waves that had by then all turned to harps. The wind whipped my scarf, whipped through me. I was living out my freedom. I was paying my respects to herself, rejuvenating my connection, pulling myself like a thread through the shoreline. On that morning, I felt that I was one of the 10,000 broken shells tumbling in the surf, or one of the pelicans with her belly skimming the ocean, open-billed, gulping in the mystery firsthand. I told myself, this is my spirituality. To dance with waves, sand, birds, and shells, to immerse ourselves in these earthly things, whether in jubilation at the earth's beauty, or sadness over her ruin, or to simply participate in earth's small, unceasing, familiar rhythms, is to embody a spirituality of naturalness. When we do these things, we are stitching ourselves into the tattered fabric of the earth. We are learning, as the Lakota Sioux say, to live well in the natural world. Cut off from nature, we get sick inside. We lose our sense of belonging to the earth. This belonging fuels the core of energy inside us that sustains our activism. And when we lose that, we lose drive and power. We are not able to be the tree that holds the leaning. The more we draw the earthly into our spirituality, the more responsive we become, and our responsiveness calls forth the responsiveness of others. The afternoon after my early morning dance, I walked along the beach, picking up trash. Soon Sandy came to help. Then two people, perfect strangers, joined us. Further down the beach, a few children came to help. Before it was over, I'd handed out half a box of garbage bags. Sandy joked that I was the Pied Piper of beach trash. That evening, I realized that what had happened in the afternoon was not at all separate from the connection I'd felt to the earth early that morning as I pirouetted along the waves. The Now. A spirituality of feminine naturalness not only teaches us that the earth is our true home, but that this moment is our true home. You cannot step twice into the same river, wrote Heraclitus, for other waters are continually flowing on. This river is your life, and it is different every moment. The important thing, the sacred, empowering, natural thing, is to step deeply into it every single moment and be there as fully as you can, seeing as clearly as you can. Being fully in the now implies a certain acceptance of what is. When my children were small, I read them Winnie the Pooh, who, as you may know, is an exceptionally enlightened bear. One thing Pooh says is, a fish can't whistle and neither can I. When the enlightened Pooh says this, he's accepting the clear reality that things are as they are, says the little book, The Tao of Pooh. That doesn't mean we need to stop changing and improving. It just means that we need to recognize what's there. When we do this, we start to come home to the now. We accept where we are standing in the river right now, and we enter the immediacy of it, even when it's painful, because by doing so we are being present to our lives. We are attending to them, living them with awareness. If you think about it, how else can we be fully alive? As we become alive and awake to the present moment, we start to look deeply into things and see how we can change ourselves and how we can transform our situation. And gradually, as we change, things around us change. We may not realize it, but by being present and looking deeply, we are becoming activists. We start to see that the roots of injustice, the oppression of the feminine, and the planetary crisis are, after all, linked to how we shop and dispose of our garbage and react to the morning news and ignore our bodies and teach our children and swallow our anger at our mates. Without this deep looking at the present unfolding of our lives, we tend to perpetuate the old ways. Indeed, one reason that great social movements, including the feminist movement, sometimes hold within them pockets of unresolved anger and hostility, is their failure to be present. Their members tend to live trapped in old patterns of seeing, reacting to the past rather than focusing on the transforming potential of now. The Ordinary. The really important question is, what does the sacred feminine have to do with how we go through an ordinary day? In a way, all sacred experience and all journeys of soul lead us to the smallest moment of the most ordinary day. Yesterday, I woke too early and lay there listening to the dogs snoring beneath the bed. I watched Sandy's unshaven face lying on the pillowcase, the same face I have waked to for 26 years, and the same light, as always, was expanding across the room, falling in like bright water, making me want to stay there and watch how it flowed over us, illuminating a continent of small things. My glasses beside the bed, my journal, piles of books, Sandy's terry cloth robe coiled around the bedpost, the ficus plant in the corner grown large from all the watering. There were the children's pictures framed on the dresser. Babies then, gone away now. I noticed the place beside the closet where Mother and I hung the wallpaper crooked. I felt my flesh pressed against the sheet, pressed upon this moment. From the bathroom I heard the faucet dripping, then the murmur of my breath moving in and out of my nostrils, and behind it all, the pendulum clock in the distance, clicking like a metronome atop a piano, creating the domestic cadence against which this morning and all other mornings played. I rose to make the coffee. I walked to the door and paused. When I looked back, I saw my life shining within every ordinary thing. And I was seized by the same feeling I get whenever I see the ocean, the feeling that it is all too much to behold, too beautiful, too much to bear, and I was filled with an aching love for it. In the next instant, the moment was gone, and I was climbing down the stairs, walking into the kitchen, into a day of small, humble, distracting things, and somehow nothing seemed more holy to me than just being there, naturally myself, in the midst of it. Such moments are not as common for me as I might wish, but when they come, they leave me with a willingness to relate to my ordinary space, my work and family and friends and all the mundane duties, more authentically. I want to be in my feminine center in the midst of those plain places, and to tell the truth and be the truth. I heard a story about a man who went about the countryside asking people how they would spend their last day on earth. He came upon a woman who was out hoeing her garden, surrounded by her children and neighbor women. He decided he might as well ask her, too, even though he didn't expect much of an answer. "Woman," he asked, "if this were your last day on earth, if tomorrow it was certain you would die, what would you do today?" "Oh," she said, "I would go on hoeing my garden and taking care of my children and talking to my neighbors." The woman knew that there is nothing more important than being fully where we are, in the plain, ordinary events, day in and day out. When what we have learned and lived during our journey begins to flow into these places, into our garden hoeing and our child rearing and our relationships with our neighbors, then we begin to affect the world around us in the most intimate, natural, and profound ways. I think women understand that we create change as we live out the experiences of our souls in the common acts of life. Daughters, the women are speaking. When I went to Crete, my daughter Anne was a senior in high school. One day, browsing in a shop in Heraklion, I saw a small statue of Nike, and I wanted Anne to have it. Nike was known as the goddess of victory, she who gives the power to prevail and then celebrates with us when we do. Within her, two things are brought together, womanhood and power. In ancient times, Nike was the one who came and placed the laurel wreaths on the heads of Olympic winners. The Nike statue in the shop held a wreath in her outstretched hand, and she was standing very erect, proud, strong, and stalwart, like a tiny reflection of embodied female power, as if she were announcing, "Okay, world, here I am." When I gave the statue to Anne, I told her about Nike, about the feminine divine. Anne already knew much about the journey I'd been on for the last few years, but now I told her even more. Anne turned the statue over in her hands. By giving her that gift, I was trying to tell her what was possible, because there's no female journey without someone to show us what's possible. I was trying to say, your female soul, your deepest self, is a thing of deep beauty and power, a thing to be embraced and celebrated. It is there for you if you choose it. The wise old woman had come in my dream, saying, "Your heart is a seed. Go, plant it in the world." Yet where I most wanted to plant it was in my own daughter's life. Anne put Nike on a little chest in the corner of her room. We didn't talk about her again. Months went by, and then, too suddenly, It was time for Anne to go to college. I did not sleep very well the night before she left. It's odd, the things you think about. I remembered her 5 years old, bursting into the house to tell me the magnolia had a flower on it, or that there was a cloud over the neighbor's house that looked like a bear sitting on a mushroom, and I had to come see. I remembered her 100 different ways, at 100 different times, and I said goodbye to the little girl. I was saying goodbye to myself, too, to all those mothering years of my life when I would go outside and stand for an inordinate amount of time trying to picture a bear on a mushroom. But at the same time, beneath the sadness of the ending, I felt the kind of exhilaration that comes after you have invested much for a very long time and finally see the results. I knew joy, not sadness, was the thing that would last, the joy that she had arrived at this astonishing place where she was on her own. I had bought a card with a turtle on the front, which I intended to give her the next day. I opened it now in the late hours of the night and sat thinking about what I wanted to tell her. In the end, I wrote what a gift her life was to me, then scrawled one bit of parting wisdom, condensing it all down to this. Whatever else you do, listen to your deepest self. Love her and be true to her. Speak her truth, always. The next day, we drove to the college and began to unpack Anne's things in her new dormitory room. She unzipped a suitcase and, to my surprise, lifted out Nike. "Where should I put her?" she asked. Just that, where should I put her? But so much more was going on than that simple question. As I watched her place Nike first on the top of the desk, then on her dresser, the moment grew more and more transparent to me. Some kind of transmission was taking place, a transmission of female wisdom from my life to hers, a passing on of consciousness, of the potential for sacred poetry that lives in the feminine soul. All this was symbolized in the little statue with the laurel wreath. The gift was going with her into the world. The daughters of your daughters of your daughters are likely to remember you and most importantly follow in your tracks, writes Clarissa Pinkola Estes. I like her here, Anne said, staring at the dresser, tilting her head a little. Yes, I said. I like her there too. As I left, I propped the card containing my message beside Nike, then held my daughter close for a long time. On the drive home, I remembered these lines from a favorite poem by Linda Hogan. Daughters, the women are speaking. They arrive over the wise distances on perfect feet. Daughters, I love you. As Sandy drove, I leaned my head against the car window, wanting to weep at the wonder of taking a feminine journey, of daughters receiving the precious thing we bring back from our journey. We take our journeys and bring back the gifts. We find our hearts and we plant them. We do it as we voice our souls and find our authority, and we do it also in the quiet enactment of a natural spirituality. We do it for ourselves, but also for all the daughters, all the women, all the men, all creation. We do it out of love for the women we are becoming, out of love for the earth. We do it because we are the change the world is waiting for. The story. Sandy and I drove a long time in silence. I was lost in reverie, thinking about my experience, following the threads of memory all the way back to the beginning, aware suddenly how much I had changed. A woman is transfigured into being by a long collection of events and moments, and it can start any sort of way.
You sure are quiet, Sandy said.
I smiled at him. Just thinking.
About what?
Oh, about the slow, hidden way a woman's life changes.
Hidden how?
Well, let's say there's this woman, this every woman, and one night she has a dream about giving birth to herself. She doesn't realize it, of course, but she's about to be pregnant with a new feminine life. And sure enough, she starts to get wake-up calls, an odd slip of tongue, maybe, in which she hears herself putting the word father before her own name. The next thing she knows, she's uncovering the feminine wound, hers and the church's and the whole world's. She tries to run away from the whole thing, but before she gets too far, she finds herself on a beach with dancing women, celebrating an experience of female souls she can't even comprehend, but the down deep makes her long for the mysterious thing she's lost.
He looked at me. And this woman decides to find it.
Yes, but first she decides she has to look honestly at her female life. When she does, she starts to see what a good daughter to patriarchy she's been, how she's created her life by blueprints that aren't even her own. Then she looks at the church, her marriage, the whole culture, the way it really is, the way women have been devalued and excluded, how the feminine has been suppressed and left out. And she knows for the first time that the absence of the divine feminine has left a hole in her. She says no more. She gets angry. No, make that furious. But she's real scared, too. She feels stuck, so lodged in the way it is she can't imagine anything else. Until one day she goes into a drugstore and sees her daughter on her knees before these men who are laughing at her subordinate posture, and something happens to this woman. The car slowed a little as Sandy grew more absorbed in what I was saying. I realized he was hearing the unbroken tale of my journey, albeit the ultra-condensed version, for the first time, and in a way, I was too. So the woman decides to go away and reassess, to follow her own wisdom, which is starting to trickle down to her. She decides to let her old life collapse at her feet, to risk everything.
I bet her husband remembers that part real well, he said.
Okay, so it's hard on them both. But it's worth it, because in the end, they find a whole new marriage. Plus, the woman finds this circle of trees, this space of sacred feminine experience unlike anything she's ever known, and deep inside her something says home. She learns to dance in that circle, to create rituals, to open herself to the unknown. She discovers a myth, or maybe it discovers her, and it tells her what she needs to know about rebirthing as a woman. She faces off with the patriarchal voices she's internalized, buries the patriarchy in a shoebox, buries her old female self. I paused. It was the oddest thing, the way the story was forming as I spoke. All the pieces, the trivial and the terrible, falling out of my mouth into this little pattern of meaning. It awed me as much as if a child had spilled a jigsaw puzzle on the floor and it had fallen into a picture. This is my story, I thought.
Go on, said Sandy.
Then she opens her arms to the divine feminine, discovering her in ancient places and traditional places, but mostly inside her own self. And she loves this presence with all her heart. Her consciousness starts expanding. She discovers she's not separate from anything, that earth, body, and mother are all divine, and this knowing changes everything. She discovers there is fire in her, a passionate struggle for women. She starts to heal, too. She moves deep into nature, into relationships with female friends, into herself. She comes upon a Matryoshka doll, and it teaches her to honor her feminine legacy. She goes to Crete and finds healing. She goes back to the monastery and dances around the altar and learns to forgive. And one night on the beach, she sits with a sea turtle and is overwhelmed with love for her female self. All this causes her to give up the idea she's powerless. She starts to feel her strength, her own authority as a woman. She dreams about buffalo, and even they help her reclaim her power. Then, of course, she finds out that she has to bear witness to all this, that she has to plant her heart out there in the world. She decides to be brave, to play her music on a whole different lyre. More than anything, she wants to be a one-in-herself woman, to have her sacred feminine experience become a natural part of her life. And then one day she's sitting in the car beside her husband, having just taken their daughter to college, thinking of all these things. There was silence in the car. He reached over and covered my hand with his. My life had been miles and miles of reconstruction, but sitting in the car that evening, I felt glad for it. I was even glad for the miles and miles of my life before the reconstruction. For a time, I'd thought of that part of my life as wrong. But our earlier lives aren't wrong. They are just pre-construction, that's all. Our lives are meant to unfold, to evolve, and that's good. The only wrong thing, perhaps, is permanently hesitating on the verge of courage, which would prevent this process from taking place. It's a process that doesn't really end. That's why, after 8 years on this journey, I cannot write an ending, and the story I told Sandy in the car keeps forming. I am still waking up, still crossing thresholds, still healing, still grounding, and always scraping up the bravery to plant my heart in the world. Nothing happens neatly on journeys such as this. There is no 1-2-3 program. There are no guarantees, and no two journeys unfold the same way. Every woman's story of finding the sacred feminine brims with its own unique events, risks, complexities, pains, and rewards. And every story is a luminous thread that becomes part of a larger fabric, a fabric we are weaving together for the whole world, and this fabric is a thing of immense importance and beauty. I look back now, and I am grateful. I recall that whenever I struggled, doubted, wondered if I could pull my thread into this fabric, someone or something would always appear, a friend, a stranger, a figure in a dream, a book, an experience, some shining part of nature, and remind me that this thing I was undertaking was holy to the core. I would learn again that it is all right for women to follow the wisdom in their souls, to name their truth, to embrace the sacred feminine, that there is undreamed voice, strength, and power in us. And that is what I have come to tell you. I have come over the wise distances to tell you, she is in us. This concludes the reading of The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, 20th Anniversary Edition, A Woman's Journey from Christian Tradition to the Sacred Feminine, by Sue Monk Kidd. Copyright 1996, by Sue Monk Kidd. Introduction to the 20th Anniversary Edition, copyright 2016, by Sue Monk Kidd. Permission acknowledgments for third-party materials. The Society of Authors as the Literary Representative of the Estate of Virginia Woolf. Kabir, Ecstatic Poems, by Robert Bly. Copyright 2004, by Robert Bly. Reprinted by permission of Beacon Press, Boston. This book was read by Carrington McDuffie. This unabridged recording was produced by arrangement with Harper One, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.